Frankly, my dear, I don't give it.
Hey, Red Butler, this is a family show. Hello, listeners. And if you don't know where to go or what to do, stay right here and listen to History Worth Hearing, a presentation of the Vashon Heritage Museum. I am your host, Chris Austin, and we have a great show for you today. We have the much-requested trivia, of course. We have Jean Finley, a longtime volunteer at the museum, and she will tell us what is the oldest object at the museum. And here's a hint, it's not Bruce Hallman. And at the end of the show, we'll have a big announcement about histories and mysteries. What is histories and mysteries all about? I don't know. I'm waiting for the end of the show. But right now, let's hear from Bianca Perla as she discusses her museum talk, Natural Wonder. And as always, we have one caveat. All our interviews were conducted over Zoom, so I apologize in advance for any sound issues. But before we begin, I do have one housekeeping chore to do. As always, corrections and retractions from the last show. Wow, quite a list here. You know what? Let's do the top three. Okay, number one, English ivy will not leave the island due to Brexit. Number two, Vashon Island was not formed when Seattle and Tacoma pushed their steepest hills into the Puget Sound. And number three, Lake Russell, which was formed during the Ice Age by retreating glaciers, is not named for Russell Wilson. Okay, now to our first interview. Okay, listeners, we have another surprise for you. We have the speaker for this month's museum talks. It is Bianca Perla, and she is the director of the Vashon Nature Center. Is that correct? Did I get it all right?
You got it all right. Yeah.
Well, welcome. Welcome. Thank you for coming on the show.
Thanks. Thanks for having me, Chris.
What we want to talk about is, as you know, the museum has a Zoom talk every month on a particular subject. And this one is on natural wonder. Is that it? Or wonders? Is there one wonder or two?
There's billions of wonders. But we're calling it natural wonder.
Okay. And that's an exhibit that's going to start outside. Is that right? At the museum, so it's people can come see it relatively soon. Mm-hmm. And you're going to give a talk about that May 13th. Mm-hmm. Right? And it's free. People just need to go to Zoom. Just go to the museum website and do a real simple registration and follow it on Zoom.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so and it's at 7 o'clock.
7 o'clock. Can you give us kind of a little teaser or what you're going to be talking about?
Yeah, sure. So this is kind of a preview to the Natural Wonder exhibit, which is all about the natural history of Vashon. So it covers all our different habitats, our relationships to the land. We're working with the Puyallup tribes, so we're getting their knowledge and culture and how they've inhabited these islands. It's going to be a big exhibit. Half of it's outside, half of it's inside. And so in my talk, what I'm trying to do is just give little previews of what will be expanded upon in the exhibit. And I'm focusing it on, you know, basically when you think about Vashon and you think about our natural history, what really defines us and makes us different from the rest of the Puget Sound, when you're talking about Puget Sound natural history, is that we are surrounded by water on all sides. So we're an island. And so I'm going to be talking a lot about what does that mean, both for the way that our habitats have evolved and our species, and also the way we interact with them. And it's, you know, created island character in humans just as much as it's created certain diversity patterns in our wildlife and plants. So I'm going to be talking about what makes us special
in terms
of our natural history.
Now, will this be going back to like the glacial period? That far?
Yeah, because that's really, I mean, the last glacial period that went, the last glacial stayed, they call it, came through, and that was called Vashon, the Vashon stayed. And so that was really where our island was birthed from that ice. So I will be starting from there because the action of those glaciers set up certain geological patterns on the island that really formed a lot of what we see today.
You know, when you think of island culture,
just in the vernacular out there, you think of something in Polynesia, Tahiti, you know, something so far away from everything that you're not getting there for months in your canoe. Mm-hmm. But this, you can basically throw a rock and hit that peninsula. How is it that we have this different variety of everything with such a small barrier, relatively?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, one example that I'll talk about a little bit is, did you know we have this little tiny snail that's about the size of a quarter of my pinky fingernail. It's tiny.
Oh my gosh.
It's called a Pristinicola spring snail. And we found it for the first time in about 2015 down in Christensen Creek. Has a lot of springs. It's real old growthy looking forest there. And the guy that was down there, who's a snail expert, I was asking him, how did these guys get here? Did they hitchhike on birds? How do they get to an island? How do they cross a mile of Colvo's Passage? You know, cougars, yeah, okay, they can swim, but these little guys? And I said, do they hitchhike on birds? He goes, no, they would dry out. And I said, well, did they float on rafts? No, they're super, super, super sensitive to salinity.
Yeah, of course.
You know, and so I said, well, then what happened? How would they have gotten here? And he said, well, they probably came across when Vashon was surrounded by fresh water.
Oh, the Russell Lake?
So Lake Russell.
Oh,
so these guys who have a life cycle of 2 years have been here for the last 13,000 years or so, maybe 14,000 years. So many, many, many generations. So we're doing DNA on them to see, do we have our own island species of little tiny Pristinicola spring snail, or is it the same as other places?
So if we have a new species, are you going to name it after you? I mean, that's kind of the discoverer of it.
My daughter discovered it. She was 8 at the time. Or no, she was less than that. She was like 6 at the time. Yeah. she didn't discover, but she found the first one at the spring. Oh, maybe she gets the name.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah. So there's, you know, little things like that. And then there's just, you know, the fact that islands, because they're smaller, and because they're slightly more isolated, tend to be a lot more vulnerable to disturbances. So if you look at our forest understory on Vashon compared to on the mainland, we have a lot less plants, a lot less diversity. And, you know, part of that is we're predator poor. So we have a lot of deer that graze, but probably also part of it has to do with some things just couldn't make it over here. You know, so there are little things like that define us differently.
You know, from what I've read about like island evolution, you know, there seems to be a tendency that something arrives at an island and it's small and it gets big, a gigantism, and you get big things like mammoths that get reduced in size because of resources. Do we have any of that? Can we see that on this island?
We do see that a little bit in our vole populations. And Ellen Kritzman was, who's a mammalogist who worked for Slater Museum at University of Puget Sound in the 80s. She was going through, she lived on the island. So a lot of the specimens she was working with were from Vashon. And she started noticing this general pattern of size where the Oregon voles from here were much bigger than the mainland of the same species. And Bergman's rule is that on islands that often happens because you don't need to be as fast when there aren't as many predators around. So you can grow bigger if you're a little, you know, if you're a prey species. And so we did some DNA tests on a very small sample size of voles. We had people turning them in. It was a great citizen science project. We had people's cats would catch them, and then the owners would bag them up and give them to us, and we sent them to the Burke Museum for some DNA testing. We never got a big enough sample size of the actual species that had the size difference to really tease it out. So it's still a work in process, and we might, when we get more funding, call for another round of cat helpers.
Years ago, I used to work in a natural history museum. it was my first time in a group of such a lot of paleontologists, and what I figured out was people tend to look like the thing they study. Is that true with the Volt lady or the guy? Because I swear this woman that studied turtles look like a turtle.
Well, I think Alan Kurtzman is much more beautiful than a Vol, in my opinion.
That was just a theory of mine. We're starting at the glacial period, and then we run up to the present in your natural wonder.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah. And the future, we look towards the future, you know, and one of the things that's defining about our time is that, you know, we're at or exceeding a lot of thresholds of change for the environment, you know? Really? And so our generation and generations after us are going to need to learn how to deal with that in some way for the survival, you know, of the human species and of the other types of animals that and plants that are associated with our time. And so we talk a little bit about that and ask for, you know, reflection on that. What are we bringing across? What tools do we have to kind of bring across those thresholds and create another future or another trajectory in our relationship with the earth? And you know, that's another place where islands really are interesting, because if you look at islands all over the world, just the fact that they are small and they're isolated creates more of an awareness in the human population of sustainability issues. And so if you look all over the world at island populations are really leading in a lot of sustainability things like energy, alternative energy. There's mm-hmm. islands in Denmark and there's islands in Tasmania and Hawaii that are all really at the forefront of renewable energy technologies. And I think part of that is because they're island environments. It's harder to get energy there. They're smaller, there's smaller communities, so it's easier to organize. And so one of the things I've been thinking about in terms of environmental challenges and overcoming them is that islands might play a role, a leadership role in figuring some creative new things out.
Well, I think that's absolutely true, because you think of some islands that aren't going to be islands, they're going to be underwater. And that gets real pretty quick when you think, you know, I got to move, because this is not a hoax.
Right.
It's a real thing. And we got to fix it.
Limited resources, climate change, species loss, those are all things that islanders feel more viscerally than people on a large mainland do.
Oh, can we make a deal with the deer on the island to just eat English ivy? Would that as many of you guys as you want, just eat the ivy.
Wouldn't that be nice if we could have a deer trainer?
What do we do about that? English ivy.
What should we do about English ivy?
How can we eradicate? It's like kudzu of the South.
Oh, yeah. I think really in general, my approach for invasive species is control rather than eradication. Oh. You know, they're here. You know, it's going to be really hard to get rid of them, but we can lessen their impact.
Well, I've heard about the invasive carp, and one mitigation is to teach people to eat them.
Mm-hmm.
Can we do that with ivy? Would that make a salad? Would that be?
I think there are some medicinal properties of ivy. Maybe if you can expand on those, we can all be rich.
I like that idea. How long is the exhibit up for, you know?
I'm not sure. That's something more for the Heritage Museum to decide, but they've been talking about keeping it up for definitely for a year and maybe more. They're also in the process of maybe 2 years is the kind of the thinking, and they're also in the process of redoing their permanent exhibit. And so it's possible that parts of our this is a special exhibit in the museum, and so parts of this exhibit would carry over and become parts of the permanent exhibit eventually.
Is there any talk about maybe taking this exhibit and the ideas behind it and make it a traveling show? Because you know, there are other islands that like maybe don't have the resources or the, you know, the nature center say, hey, we just need the ideas or the ideas to put out to our citizens. Is there any talk about that?
That's a really good idea. If I'm still standing after this first exhibit gets up, then maybe I'll think about it.
Well, you know, you've already done all the hard work.
Yeah, no, it actually is a good idea. And actually that reminds me that there is a component this summer that we're really excited to have. And you know, really what some of the magic of this exhibit is how many people are being brought together around creating it. And this is a traveling component is the Natural History Museum, which is based here on Vashon, but is a traveling natural history museum. Oh. And they're going to display their award-winning orca whale people tent, Protectors of the Sea. And it's a collaboration with the Lummi tribe. And there are carvings from the Lummi tribe. And there's a 3D or a visual video display that's projected inside this tent, and we're going to set it up in the backyard this summer, and that's part of our concurrent activities with the exhibit called Living Waters. So we're going to have we're having a panel actually coming up May 20th that's all about salmon in the Salish Sea and speakers for that. And then we're going to have this whale tent, and then we're going to have a panel on indigenous leaders in the environmental movement.
Okay.
That's associated with that. So that'll be pretty exciting. So,
anything else you want to mention? How great your interviewer is? Anything?
The interview has been great. And the interviewer too. Yeah. No, just that I'm super excited about this and you know, all of the players that are involved and super grateful for the community and everybody who's contributed to it. And I really encourage people to come out and see the talk and also come and see the natural history exhibit when it's up, because I think it's going to be something pretty special.
Well, thank you very much. I know you put a lot of hard work into it. Yeah. And the Nature Center itself. So Vashon, thanks you. I thank you. And I'm sure it'll be wonderful. I can't wait to see it.
All right. Thanks.
Good luck.
Okay, it's trivia time. And we have four questions for you today. Number one, who was the unofficial mayor of Docton? Number two, what was the original name for Camp Self? And when did it become a campfire camp? Number three, when was the maiden voyage of the Virginia V? And last question, number four, how many campfire girls did the Virginia V transport to Camp Self? So cogitate about that. We'll have the answers for you at the end of the show.
We have a treat for you today. We have Jean Finley. She's a longtime associate with the museum. And we wanted to bring her in and ask her how she got interested in the museum, what are her favorite parts of the program, that sort of thing. So welcome to the show, Jean. What can you tell us?
Well, thank you, Chris, for having me. Well, as to getting started with the museum, 2007, I was doing research for a book called The Mosquito Fleet of South Puget Sound for Arcadia, and I came to look at the steamboat collection. So that was my first introduction to that wonderful research room where we have all the white books and, you know, there was just, and pictures. Oh my goodness, the pictures were great. And everybody was so friendly and helpful. And so then I was real busy working on the book for quite a long time after that. But my reception had been so warm and welcoming that I decided to volunteer. So my entry level as a volunteer, although I was fascinated by the research room, I had seen two ladies sitting at the table, and they had big bound volumes of old beachcombers, or not even beachcombers, old copies of the island newspapers. Mm-hmm. And they were extracting vital statistics, births, deaths, marriages. And there was a format to follow that on a little index card. And I thought, that's my kind of job. I want to do that. So, but my training took place as a docent, and that's a really valuable way to enter the museum if you want to be a volunteer, because it gives you the opportunity to get to know the collection. And that's critical, you know. Why do we have a museum if it's not to appreciate all the artifacts that we have and the opportunities for learning? So I did that, and gradually I did shift over, and I did extract vital statistics for a long time. And I've worked on several different committees as a result. I've been on the board. I now pretty much confine myself to collection care, because there is just so much involved in working with the collection. So that's a long history. So I would have say, you know, how many years? 12, 13, 14 years that I've been associated with this. So some of my time has been spent on the education committee and monitoring field trips. That's another way to get to know the collection. You know, what's going to be interesting to a student? What can you point out that they can learn from or that they might never have heard of before? So always when the students come in, we ask them before they even enter the museum, we've got a small group, and we say, as I take you around, I want you to see if you can identify what you think is the oldest object in the museum. And you get really interesting answers. One child one time chose the cider press because it had rust on it, and if it was rusty, it had to be old. Almost all of them always choose the tree stump because it has a timeline on it. And of course, that tree is really, really old. And you can see those events in history that go back far enough that a child just has no comprehension of how long ago that could be. And neither of those are it. The true answer is a Willow Point arrowhead in the Native American section. They are not labeled particularly by name or date or anything like that. So there's a lot of opportunity to tell the children or get the children to figure out certain things. So one of the questions that we like to ask, maybe it is labeled 7000 BC.
Oh my gosh.
So you ask the child, your small group of children, and it's interesting that, you know, really younger children, second grade, they haven't had much experience with negative numbers. So that's real hard for them. Mm-hmm. And seventh graders, you know, depending, scratch their heads a little bit, but often they just say, oh, that's easy. You estimate about 2000 years in the century since the birth of Christ, add the 7,000 on the other side of the birth of Christ before he was born, 9,000 years old.
That is amazing.
Oh, yeah, it is amazing.
And do they have it documented where that was discovered, where they found that arrowhead?
On Vashon Island.
Okay, but not like Jones Point or...
My guess it would have been, of course, there are several sites that it could have come from. The particular one was probably from the Sherman Homestead property.
Oh, okay.
And so that would put it here on Quartermaster Harbor, up by Portage, perhaps.
So how did that come to the collection? Was it handed down by family, or what's the provenance of you?
One of the points that you want to make before the students even come into the museum is that not only is the museum entirely run by volunteers, well, we do have some paid staff now, but for a long time, for the first 45 years of its existence, the museum did not have any paid volunteers. And all of the materials in the museum were donated by island families.
I see.
And of course, our one of our guidelines is that we accept artifacts that have only to do with Vashon. We have very limited space, so we can't look up to a larger realm, you know, and collect from shores other than ours. Mm-hmm. So yes, families donate to the museum. And because we are run by volunteers, we have limited funds. We don't have a budget for a session, that is to say we've got a gap in our collection. and we don't go out and shop for things that we need to fill in our collection. So it's amazing how diverse it is, given that we can't and don't have a budget for buying things that we might need. But there's a stone mall. That is, it's you hold it and you punch down with it, straight down.
Like a pestle almost?
Yeah, kind of like a pestle. Yeah. But you have to, it's a kind of a crushing object. Oh. When you pick it up, it's, though it's stone and it's probably 8 inches long, it's been beautifully shaped so that when you wrap your fingers around it, it just fits in your hand.
Oh, really?
Obviously, we can't hand that artifact around to people to handle. So I purchased from British Columbia, I believe it was, on eBay actually, a broken mall, but it had the handle so that you can hand that artifact around and see how easy it is to use this. And they can handle it, you know, if they drop it, the world isn't over with. Yeah.
So that's probably millennia of hands on that object have worn it.
That, and the fact that they would have had to shape that. Mm-hmm. Whatever tools they used, whatever primitive tools they used, and however much time it took, they probably didn't have a whole workbench full of stone. You know? So, yeah, you just, I think handling something like that or being able to touch it, not just look at it, makes you appreciate it even more.
I completely agree. I think that makes it much more intimate. And like someone thousands of years ago is doing what I'm doing now, holding this object.
Exactly.
I think that really brings it home to that.
Yeah.
How interesting.
That's a really wonderful part of the exhibit, the Native American part of it. So now you need to ask me what my second favorite object is.
Please tell me.
All right. I'd be glad to. It's a picture of two people in the maritime section, Gert and Chance Wyman, Gertrude Wyman and Chauncey, her husband, who was called Chance.
Yeah.
And they're famous on the island. Chance was a steamboat captain.
He was Captain Wyman.
Yeah.
Oh, I've read about this guy.
And And he partnered for a time with Frank Bibbins, and then he partnered with John Manson, and he was part of the Vashon Navigation Company. Oh. Interesting thing about Gert is that she, not the first, I have seen it said that she was the first on Puget Sound. That's not true. She was the third woman to receive her master's license, which meant she was qualified to pilot a steamboat.
Is that right? Wow.
Yeah. Wow. Right. Wow. And she and her husband both piloted the Verona, which was, I can't tell you what year it was built, 1906, something like that. You know, so that kind of pegs where it is in history.
Yeah. So what brought you to write this book?
I edited the Anderson Island book for the author. And when her book was published, she had a big coming out party and invited all of the people who had helped to write it. Well, you know, you don't write a book in isolation, that you're just kind of the conduit through which information flows. And it's a lot of other people that help you along the way. And so at her party, she invited a man from Gig Harbor, and he had provided several of the photographs, mostly of boats that were in her book. Mm-hmm. And they owned a piece of property also on Anderson Island, so they had ties there. And I'd known his wife in high school, in fact, so that was a long time ago. And we got to chatting, and Arcadia had asked him to write a book about the mosquito fleet. And he didn't want to write the book. He didn't like to write. He liked to collect pictures.
Oh.
And so the author of the Anderson Island book said, you know, you two should get together. Robin Patterson can supply the pictures. You can write the text. And that's what we did.
Wonderful. You know, I've read it years ago. I think I still have it around here somewhere.
Yeah.
And I really recommend it. So just, you know, maybe a little plug. How could our listeners get this book? Where could they get it?
Oh, well, you can buy it in the museum gift shop.
Hey, that's a great idea.
And you can order it online, you know. I didn't come cold to the project. That is, I come from a family where almost everybody, if you didn't have a boat or pilot a boat, you were excluded from the family.
The black sheep.
Exactly. So, you know, I grew up around boats all the time. And my grandfather was an engineer, and my other grandfather was a sailboat, a big, you know, three-master sailboat.
Really?
Yeah.
What a pedigree.
Yeah, and all my great uncles were all either tugboat or steamboat men. So, you know, it was familiar territory.
This was destiny.
Yeah. The interesting thing about that book, and I'm sorry this takes us away from the museum, but I just have to say that of all the people who have bought the book, I have never had a woman buy it for herself. Talk about a great divide between genders. And I autographed it. She would say, "This is for my father or my husband or my," you know. Interesting.
Oh, it is interesting, except for Gert Wyman.
I think that's one of my favorite pictures, is because here was a woman who had the capability, not just of piloting the boat. I mean, you had to know what to do if the engine went out.
Yeah.
Yes, you had an engineer on board, but you were in charge, you know.
That was such a man's world.
And yes.
My hat's off to her and to her husband.
And their son grew up also to be somebody in the boat world. I don't know that he was a captain. I think he sailed on the Pacific Ocean. That is to say, he worked on boats out on the Pacific. So he was seagoing as opposed to.
Yeah, blue water boater, yeah. I guess. Huh.
Exactly.
Interesting.
Well, one of the things that we prepare for our children, in case we get to the end of a tour and we have time left, well, we've never come to the end of the tour and had any time left. We're lucky to get all the way around the museum before we have to stop. And there are tons more things to show them. One of my other favorites is a big brass spittoon. And you say to the kids, "What is this object?" And they look at it and they, you know, it's shaped like a big bowl with a big tip on it, you know. So you explain to them that, you know, a long time ago, men used to not just smoke cigarettes, they chewed tobacco and it would get soggy and wet and they'd have to spit. Well, it was disgusting because a lot of them wanted to spit on the sidewalk or spit on the floor. And so gentle people had a spittoon for them to spit in. You should see the looks on their faces.
That's so true. I mean, and the poor guy's got to empty those, you know. what a
special bowl was considered more sanitary. I just love that.
For the upper crust,
exactly.
Spittoon.
Better manners.
But they sip tea.
We have on display a candlestick telephone. And so one of the things you need to get them to understand is why it's called a candlestick. It has the mouthpiece at the top and a little hook that you put the receiver onto. And then it's got a long stem like a lamp and then a base. So it looks like a tall candlestick holder. Okay. And the dial is down on the base.
Oh.
And it is more, it's wonderful that we can hand them that and say, "Show me how you would use this object." And
I mean, even a dial phone, how do you use that? Must be especially hard.
Exactly. And oh yes, that. And we also have an old Remington typewriter.
Oh my goodness.
And that's a fun one because, you know, how do you load the paper? How do you correct a mistake? How do you, and they love to try and type on it. And they love watching the keys come forward and strike the platen. You know, I mean, it's just so foreign to anything they know. Those are wonderful things to get them to see how far the technology has evolved.
Yeah, yeah.
How far we have come. But should we get done and should we want to expand their knowledge a little bit, we have a little quiz. You want to take a little quiz?
Okay.
Okay. So this is one of those two truths and a lie. And you have to pick from the three statements which one is the truth and which one is the lie.
Okay.
So assuming they have been through the museum, and you've talked about a lot of these things. So here's the first statement. The oldest item is an arrowhead. The oldest item is made of a natural material. The oldest item in the museum is a tree.
Okay, well, that one's easy because you just told me. So it's the first two are true.
That's right. And the tree, you know, if they pick the tree stump that we have, that's a kind of a distractor. But if you've been paying attention, you know that it can't be that.
The tree went back to 1600 or something, didn't it?
Something like that, yeah.
That's pretty old, but that doesn't beat 7000 BC.
No, that's true. It does not. You can touch the typewriter. You can touch the piano. You can touch the boat models.
Oh, well, I would say that you cannot touch the boat models. That's the false one.
That's right. And the Virginia 5 is supposed to be under a cover, but it's not yet. It will be eventually, I'm sure. But the piano, you're invited to look at the piano, because when you press down some of the keys, you can see this is a piano that came from Vashon College.
Oh, really? How interesting.
Yes. And some of the students signed their names on the side of the key. So you can show them.
What were the keys made out of? Were they ivory?
Yes.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Wow.
It's just an old, you know, upright piano.
Sure. But, you know, we on one of our other radio shows, we talked about Vashon College and their cantatas that they had students over from Tacoma to sing. And, boy, mm-hmm. I accompanied them.
On that piano, I'm yeah. sure.
Wow.
Still got really good tone. So, we can do one more.
Okay.
Item, okay. Natives used a stone maul to pound.
Okay.
Horses are harnessed with a yoke. The piano is from Vashon College.
We just talked about that. And I think it's the horses because aren't oxen yoked?
And yes.
They're not.
Got it, Chris.
Oh, boy.
You're smarter than a second grader.
I think I'm luckier maybe, but I don't know about smarter.
No, if they've been paying attention, these are all easy because they would have been exposed to the answers on the way through. We would have talked about the oxen yoke and why oxen were used, you know, because they're great, big, strong, hefty animals. And then invited them to look at the size of the yoke, you know.
Yes, yes. And what an interesting, fun tour. And how old would you get kids for tours?
Most of our students are elementary age. We've done seventh grade for several years, and that's about as old as we get. And the youngest we've had preschoolers. Preschoolers are very challenging.
Oh my gosh. Yeah.
The attention span is shorter, and you really do need to have a lot of techniques for handling even a small group of a lot of children.
Well, I think preschoolers and teenagers are probably in the same.
Oh, the teenagers.
Your attention span.
Yeah. The teenagers are really very, well, our kids are just really respectful and wonderful.
Oh, that's great. That's great.
And they ask good questions, you know.
Yeah.
Participatory, that's really fun. And
that's good to hear. I don't have kids, so I have very limited experience. So.
Well, lots of our volunteers are shy about working with children because they haven't had an opportunity. They may have grandchildren. That's a very limited experience.
Sure.
But it's been a long time since they raised a child of their own, say.
Yeah.
And yet, when they come in, if the teacher knows, you know, they've made their arrangements and the kids are coming and they've set the tone for what happens when they get there. Mm. And we get them and they're ready. They're ready to listen. They're ready to lean into the questions, to raise their own questions.
Oh,
you know.
Wonderful.
So it's a real reciprocatory, I think I said that right, process. And it works both ways. You know, the better the children are, the better the tour leader is.
Sure. They I can, you know, people that like to teach, and I like to teach, and I love questions that you know, you can answer and participate with the students. And, you know, it's a different environment. It's not as strict as sitting in a classroom. I'm sure
exactly.
It's a full experience.
It is exciting. I won't deny that. It's exciting for kids to be in that kind of an environment and out of the classroom. That's true. But for small children, it doesn't work so well for older children. For small children, you say, we're going to sit here. You're going to sit in kind of a little semicircle around me. And I want you to sit on your hands.
Oh, okay. What a great idea.
And then you say, do you have any questions? You know, what do you think this object is? Or, well, how was it used? You know, that kind of
thing. I still have people tell me to sit on my hands.
Little things like that, it helps. So,
well, Jean, thank you so much for taking the time to do this. This is a real pleasure. And, you know, it sounds like you've really been an asset for the museum.
It's fun to work there. You know, if you're thinking, if you have free time, and who has a lot of free time after they retire, we're a great place to work.
Okay. Thank you again, Jean.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
It is answer time for our trivia questions. Question number one, who was the unofficial mayor of Docton? And the answer is Theo Barry. He was the owner of the Docton store and the Works Progress Administration Commissioner for the Docton Park and the Docton Sidewalk projects. So sounds like a great guy for an unofficial mayor. Number two, what was the original name for Camp Self and when did it become a campfire camp? Well, the original name was Lucetta Beach. And in 1910, Campfire was founded in Lake Sebago, Maine by Luther and Charlotte Gulick. It was America's first non-sectarian, interracial, national organization for girls. And in 1921, thanks to the generous community support, Campfire raised $9,000 to purchase the site on Vashon Island where it remains today. Question number three, when did the maiden voyage of the Virginia V take place? That would be June 11th, 1922, so not too far away from 100 years ago. And last question, how many campfire girls did the Virginia V transport to Camp Self? Over 1 million. That really surprised me. So, there's your trivia answers, and I know you got them all right, because I got smart listeners.
Okay, listeners, unless you've been living under what's under a rock, you may not have heard of Histories and Mysteries. That's an event sponsored by the Vashon Heritage Museum. And to tell us more about it are Kevin and Martha from Enjoy Productions. Welcome.
Thank you.
Hi, Chris. Nice to be here.
Oh, thanks for coming. So you guys are the ringmasters? I don't know. Is that the right word?
That's good.
I like ringmasters.
We have a circus background.
That lets us twirl our mustaches with evil glee.
Nice. Snidely whiplash like. Yes, I like that.
Exactly.
I might wear a top hat. I don't know yet.
I'm a big top hat guy.
But the Histories and Mysteries thing does have a kind of an old world snidely whiplash mustache feel to it.
Ooh. Like it. So this is a fundraiser, one of the big ones for the museum, and it's happening May 22nd at 7 p.m., correct?
That sounds right.
That sounds about right. Yeah, I don't have the flyer in front of me, but that's the right date.
Yes.
We should check the time and correct it at the end
of the
interview.
We're guessing you're right, Chris. We'll be there at 7. If it's at 6, it's going to be really strange.
But it's an hour on Zoom, and we want people to register at the Vashon Heritage Museum and pop by and just have fun.
It's going to be a blast, actually. Yeah. I mean,
just to be clear, because we're so in such a strange state of COVID right now, they don't have to go to the museum to register. They just need to
go
to the
website.
No, I'm
sorry. Yes, I should have.
No, no, it's okay. But I could imagine that being confusing right now. Yeah. Everything is a little confusing.
We're going to get back to in-person pretty darn quick, but this one is definitely going to be a show, and it's
virtual.
Really super, super, super fun.
Yeah. Well, and it'll be on Zoom, so there's like a chat stream, and people can talk with us, and we'll talk with them, and there'll be quizzes.
Oh, yeah, that's the history and mysteries part.
Yes. Well, first of all, the one question I want to ask you, entertainment has been one of the hardest hit sectors of our economy, if you will. And how have you guys coped? I mean, I know you put on other fundraisers, but here you got to do this all, over the... Well,
Chris, we're on Zoom right now, and if people could see us on Zoom, they would see that we have a studio microphone and a pin light in front of us and a green screen behind us, and... You know, we do the same amount of Zoom meetings everybody else does, but we also do some production via Zoom, and certainly a lot of production for us this year at Vashon Center for the Arts on stage with cameras and our production crew in the booth, putting it all together and getting videos and interviews and then pushing it out onto YouTube. It's been quite a transformation for us.
Do you think this will, when things get back to normal, air quotes, will you continue this for part of your going forward as part of your business?
You know, we have the technology and it's been extremely useful in a few ways that could continue. We, for example, in early February of this year, we did a 24-hour fundraiser for a circus and school in Battambang, Cambodia. And we were able to do this huge international event over a huge amount of time and space intimately for audiences in France and Australia and Poland and South America, because it was on, it was electronic.
There's been silver linings galore of this distant learning and distant entertainment. Now, we hope to get back to live for sure, but to the extent that people are still not going to want to go out, because there's going to be a population that probably won't want to go out, at least initially, then we'll be doing what are referred to as hybrid events, which is scary but necessary.
So I can imagine people out there, and I'm not saying like myself, but I'm not saying not myself, I'm just too lazy to go out, COVID or no COVID.
Well, there's that.
Well, the amount of entertainment that's gone online, as well as innovative ways of doing stuff online, is just amazing. I mean, necessity is the mother of invention, and so many artists have figured out ways to produce.
Silver linings, as Kevin said.
Yeah, and we've worked, again, internationally. We worked a lot of groups on Vashon, but groups across the country that we've worked with. The Heritage Museum's event is uniquely well-suited to the online environment because it's storytelling, it's visuals, it's videos, and it's the brilliance of people like Cyrus and Bruce, who just have this amazing archive of stories, and we're putting them together to, over the course of an hour, tell the story of Vashon, tell the story of the history and even the future, but also this incredible museum and association that are the keepers of the stories. It's amazing. We've really come to admire and kind of be astonished by what they're doing.
Well, I think today is Give Big. The day this interview is being conducted is Give Big Day. And I was interviewing the museum. And one of the subjects that came up is, there's so many nonprofits on the island, but the museum is so unique. It is caretaker of our past, and the future generations are going to appreciate that so much. You think back like, okay, the 1918 pandemic, whoever captured that data or that history is so valuable to us. And that's what we're doing now for future generations. Mm. So it's a really unique institution. And I'm so glad that you guys are involved in its fundraising efforts. So I don't want to give away the show, but can you kind of tell us, like, any big stars? Like, I don't know, me?
Big stars. That's good. There's a really big surprise at the end that we won't tell you about, but I was really blown away by it.
One of the absolutely the coolest sort of history mystery discoveries I've ever heard about, and it sort of lends to the theme that there'll be a reveal that can continue to intrigue people. But there are plenty of stories, both the famous ones about the bike or the, Maury Island incident, that will have certain things revealed about them that people will not know. And also quaint other stories that sort of define the funny aspects of Vashon, including kinds of flora that we have and fauna that we sometimes have. And, it's especially during COVID, Vashon has been a wildly unique place and such a haven.
I also think that the island has changed a lot, not just from COVID, but from when we moved here in 89, it really has changed enormously. And I think there's a lot of people who live on Vashon now who don't necessarily have the folklore of it.
Oh,
and it's such a great opportunity to hear the stories, you know?
Well, I think that's absolutely true. I mean, anybody that, like when I move to a new place, that's the first thing I do is like go to the museum, find out where this place came from, its history. And I think this would be a good, starter for anybody that's new to the island. And
totally.
Like Bruce and Cyrus are just warehouses of information. And
we're going to make it fun. We're going to make it really fun. There's interactive quizzes with all kinds of funny information. And there's
some beautiful videos that Jeff Dunnicliffe, the amazing Jeff Dunnicliffe, is putting together. And Elsa and Siobhan at the museum staff wise are just doing a fantastic job pulling it together. And I think we're going to have several hundred people tuning in.
Oh,
I think
wonderful.
It'll be a great celebration.
Well, I have no doubt. I think it's, so worthy of your efforts to do this. I really appreciate it. What else? I don't want to give away the show. Anything else you tell us for?
Well, there will be information on exhibits that have just happened.
Oh, okay.
There was an amazing LGBTQ exhibit that has, it just looks so raucous. There's an exhibit coming up on Vashon Wilderness, that the wild island.
Yeah.
That looks awesome. I mean, there's some information about the exact specific exhibits that have happened or will happen. There's really fun information about the island itself and histories, relationships to different populations that have lived here or will live here.
It feels like it's an opportunity for pride in our place.
Yeah.
You know, we're famous for being non-vaccinators, and now we're famous for being over-vaccinators. And, you know, we're famous for being sort of the island no one has heard about. You say I'm on an island in the Puget Sound, and people are like, Bainbridge!
Whidbey!
Mercer! And I'm like, Mercer's not an island. It's so great for people, especially what Mar was saying, that people who don't know the island, to like, just celebrate the lore. It is so worthy of our pride right now, this place. And I think this is an organization that helps cultivate that.
Mm-hmm. We carry the stories, and if we don't know them and learn them and pass them on, then they'll be lost. And that would be so sad. So the Heritage Museum is just like this really raucous place. And it's not like a museum. It's not dead and like, huh, boring and dusty. It's fantastically alive. And the people working there are making it so relevant and current and vibrant. It's just very exciting.
I agree. Completely agree.
Yeah.
Well, okay. Well, anything else before we have to move on here?
Really, really encourage everyone to tune in on that event.
The 22nd.
Whether you plan to give $1,000 to the museum or not. We would love to have you there.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And as the flyer said, it's donations are not mandatory, but if you feel, $5, $1,000, anything would help. Okay.
Thanks for your time, Chris.
Well, hey, thank you both. I appreciate it.
Great to time talk to you.
Okay, I'll see you soon.
Take care.
Okay.
Bye.
Bye.
Well, there you have it. That's our show. I hope you enjoyed it. I'd like to thank my guests, Bianca Perla, Gene Finley, and Kevin and Martha from Enjoy Productions. And of course, all the people off the microphone that helped put this together. Elsa Kroonquist, Bruce Hallman, and Mike Suddeth. And if you have a topic you'd like us to cover, please email us at radio@vashonheritage.org. Now please stay tuned for the Mostly True Radio Show.